Hi, this is Susan at the Talking Information Center. This is the Senior Report. I am reading and recording on Tuesday, June 9th, 2026. This first article is from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, Focus on Healthy Aging, Volume 29, Number 6. Surgical approaches to treating skin cancer. Older adults are especially vulnerable to skin cancer. Here's how the disease is treated. If you've been diagnosed with an early stage melanoma or a non-melanoma skin cancer, removing or destroying the cancer likely will be the first step in your treatment plan. Depending on what type of cancer you have and how advanced it is, removal may mean a simple procedure performed in an outpatient setting with local anesthesia. For deeper or more advanced melanoma, procedures may need to be performed in the operating room. About 8,000 people in the United States die from melanoma each year, according to the American Cancer Society. The most common non-melanoma skin cancer is basal cell carcinoma, and it accounts for fewer than 2,000 deaths per year. Another non-melanoma skin cancer is squamous cell carcinoma. It is believed to cause 4,000 to 6,000 deaths. Dermatologists also treat actinic keratoses, a precancerous condition that can progress to squamous cell carcinoma. Basal cell and squamous cell carcinomas are curable if they are detected at an early stage, one reason why regular skin checks are advisable, particularly for people who have risk factors for skin cancer. Risk factors include having fair skin, blonde or red hair, blue or green eyes, a history of sunburns, especially in childhood, frequent sun exposure over decades, living in a region where the sun is especially intense, use of tanning beds, a personal or family history of skin cancer, and a personal history of immunosuppression due to diseases like cancer and HIV, or because of chemotherapy or other drugs that suppress the immune system. If you have any of these risk factors, get a thorough skin exam from a dermatologist every 6 months. It is important to have a skin exam by a dermatologist and be vigilant about sun protection, advises Dr. Jesse Lewin, Chief of Dermatology and Mohs Surgery at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Protect exposed skin with a broad-spectrum sunscreen that has a sun protection factor, or SPF, of at least 30, Dr. Lewin says. Reapply it every 2 hours and avoid spending time in the sun when it is most intense between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. If you do need to go out when the sun is at its strongest, wear a wide-brimmed sun hat and seek shade as much as possible. This applies to people of color also. People who have darker skin tones can also develop skin cancer in both sun-exposed and non-exposed areas, Dr. Lewin confirms. Treating actinic keratosis. Procedures that may be recommended to treat these precancerous lesions include cryotherapy, which uses liquid nitrogen to freeze the lesion. Over the next few days after treatment, the area thaws, blisters, and crusts over before healing. Photodynamic therapy, in which a medicated liquid is applied to the skin prior to exposure to a light source. The chemical is activated by the light and destroys the precancerous lesions, Dr. Lewin says. This approach is often used to treat sun damage on the scalp, face, and back of the hand. Chemotherapy or immunotherapy creams, which may also be used to treat superficial basal cell in low-risk areas. The creams may cause irritation, but can help you avoid surgery, Dr. Lewin says. Further treating skin cancer procedures that may be recommended include electrodesiccation and curettage. This involves using heat and then scraping away the lesion with a surgical instrument to destroy the cancerous cells. Wide local excision. This is the most common approach for treating non-melanoma and melanoma skin cancers on the trunk and the extremities. It removes the lesion along with a margin of normal skin. The specimen is sent to a lab for examination. the skin removed during the standard wide local excision is bread loafed in the lab, Dr. Lewin says. This means the lesion and the skin margin are sliced into several cross sections that are examined under a microscope by a pathologist. If abnormal cells are detected at the edge of the skin margin, you may need further surgery to remove a larger area. Mohs micrographic surgery. Mohs surgery, that's M-O-H-S, is performed with local anesthesia to treat non-melanoma and early-stage melanoma. Because it is a tissue-sparing approach, Mohs tends to be used in functionally or cosmetically sensitive areas like the face. Dr. Lewin adds that tissue processing during Mohs surgery is different than it is with wide local excision. Instead of bread loafing the tissue into vertical sections that do not allow for evaluation of all of the tissue removed, we remove thin layers of the entire lesion and a small skin margin. You can get a better idea of what the pathologist will be examining by imagining that you are looking down at a pie in a dish. We get to see the entire pie and the surgical margin on the slides under the microscope. And this accounts for the higher cure rate offered by Mohs. If your doctor is concerned your skin cancer is very deep or has metastasized, you may require a lymph node biopsy during your cancer surgery. When cancer spreads, abnormal cells are often found in the lymph nodes, which are small, bean-shaped structures throughout the body that play a role in immune function. To check if any spread has occurred, your surgeon will remove one or more of the lymph nodes nearest to the tumor and send them for lab testing, Dr. Lewin explains. More extensive lymph node removal may be needed if the biopsy nodes are found to contain cancer cells. In some cases, skin cancer may benefit from medication prior to or following surgery to treat cancers that have spread and prevent recurrence. Dr. Lewin notes that there are now exciting new therapies that are better tolerated than chemotherapy. Immunotherapy enhances or suppresses the immune system and has been used to treat melanoma and high-risk or metastatic squamous cell carcinoma, he says. Targeted therapy, as its name suggests, targets abnormal molecules inside the cancer cells that signal the cells to multiply out of control. The next article is from UCLA Health, May 2026, volume 23, number 5 of their publication, Healthy Years. Rethinking long-term hormone therapy for prostate cancer. A new study suggests that a shorter course may be safer without sacrificing effectiveness. For decades, hormone therapy has been a cornerstone of prostate cancer treatment for men receiving radiation, particularly those with a more aggressive disease. But a new large-scale study suggests that for many patients, longer may not be better. Researchers at the UCLA Comprehensive Cancer Center report that most of the benefits of deprivation therapy, or ADT, a treatment that lowers testosterone to slow prostate cancer growth, occur within the first 9 to 12 months. Extending treatment beyond that window appears to offer only modest additional cancer control while significantly increasing the risk of side effects. Prostate cancer treatment should not be one size fits all, says Dr. Amar Kishan, professor and executive vice chair of radiation oncology at UCLA Health and senior author of the study. These findings help doctors personalize therapy, balancing cancer control with potential side effects and other health risks. ADT, or deprivation therapy, is commonly prescribed with radiation therapy. The therapy works through testosterone suppression. It reduces testosterone levels to near zero, depriving cancer cells of the hormones they need to grow. However, long-term ADT is associated with a wide range of side effects, including hot flashes, bone and muscle loss, metabolic changes, cardiovascular complications, and cognitive or mental health effects. current clinical guidelines generally recommend 4 to 6 months of ADT for intermediate risk disease and 18 to 36 months for high risk disease, though the optimal duration has remained uncertain. The new study published in JAMA Oncology directly addresses that question. The research team conducted a review of the meta-analysis of randomized trials in cancer of the prostate consortium, which pooled data from 13 international randomized clinical trials involving over 10,000 men. Researchers compared different durations of therapy and evaluated outcomes including overall survival, cancer-specific survival, and deaths from other causes. What pleasantly surprised us was that we were able to see this pattern so clearly in a very large, high-quality data set, Dr. Kishan says. Across studies, the vast majority of benefit was achieved within the first year. The results show that the ideal length of hormone therapy for prostate cancer depends heavily on a patient's prostate cancer risk level, which is determined using established classification systems based on tumor characteristics. Low-risk patients may not need the deprivation therapy at all. Intermediate-risk patients benefit most from 6 to 12 months of therapy. High-risk patients achieve most of the survival benefit by 12 months. Very high-risk patients, a smaller subset with extremely aggressive disease, may still require longer treatment. Our findings suggest that very long-term therapy, longer than 12 months, should really be reserved for only the most aggressive cancers, Dr. Kishan says. This has major implications for men with high-risk prostate cancer. While current guidelines often recommend 18 to 36 months of the testosterone suppression therapy, the study suggests that most of these patients gain nearly all of the benefit within the first year, and that extending therapy longer may allow side effects to outweigh the advantages. Many men are understandably concerned when they hear they need hormone therapy, given its impact on energy levels, metabolism, heart health, and quality of life. The new findings offer reassurance that shorter courses may be both safer and just as effective for many patients. The therapy improves survival, especially for patients with aggressive cancer, Dr. Kishan says. But there is significant room to personalize how long patients actually need to be on it. Rather than assuming longer treatment is always better, decisions about ADT duration should take into account a patient's cancer risk, age, overall health, and existing heart or metabolic conditions, as well as personal preferences. The key takeaway is to discuss with your team what your true benefit versus risk may be, Dr. Kishan says. For many men, a shorter course is likely The following articles are from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, focus on healthy aging, May 2026 issue, which is volume 29, number 5. Surgery often the best option for aortic valve stenosis. Research suggests that catheter-based approaches are less traumatic for older adults. According to the American Heart Association, more than 13% of people age 75 and older have a type of heart valve disease called aortic stenosis. The condition forces your heart to work harder than it should, and this extra exertion initially is asymptomatic. You may not be aware that your heart is beginning to struggle when it comes to pumping oxygen-rich blood to your body. If and when the symptoms become noticeable, you may be able to alleviate them with lifestyle modifications and medications. However, Mount Sinai cardiologist Dr. Bruce Darrow notes some research that suggests waiting for aortic stenosis to worsen before treating it surgically may not be the best approach for older adults who are otherwise fit and healthy. In these individuals, surgery has a good success rate and a low risk of complications, so it can make more sense to intervene before the condition worsens, he says. Calcium buildup, a common cause. Your heart has four chambers through which blood travels on its journey to your lungs and then back out to your body. Each chamber has a valve that opens and closes as needed to maintain forward blood through the heart. The aortic valve is the last valve that blood flows through before exiting the heart through the main artery, the aorta, going to the rest of your body. Calcium is present in the blood, and as it flows through the aortic valve, it can deposit on the valve's three cusps or flaps of tissue that form the valve. Because this process of calcification, known as aortic sclerosis, occurs over time, older adults are more likely to have it. It also may be increased in smokers, people with diabetes or kidney disease, those with high cholesterol and triglycerides, and those who have a childhood history of rheumatic fever. Aortic sclerosis typically doesn't affect blood flow through the valve. However, in a small percentage of people, the condition progresses to aortic stenosis, in which the valve becomes significantly thicker and less flexible. And this narrowing means the left ventricle, the heart's main pumping chamber, has to work harder to pump blood out through the body. This extra workload weakens your heart over time, reducing blood flow to your major organs. As your heart weakens, you may feel more fatigued than usual. Other signs include feeling faint during physical activity, heart palpitations, which you may feel as a racing heartbeat or a fluttering, and angina, a painful squeezing sensation in the heart muscle. If untreated, aortic valve stenosis can lead to heart failure, heart attack, and sudden cardiac death. Aortic valve stenosis usually isn't caused by an unhealthy lifestyle, but consuming a healthy diet and getting plenty of exercise will benefit your heart. Drugs that help include ACE inhibitors, beta blockers, and diuretics. ACE inhibitors slow ventricular enlargement, beta blockers lower the heart rate, and diuretics help reduce the heart's workload by decreasing the amount of fluid in your body, Dr. Darrow says. A small 2025 Mayo Clinic study suggested that an investigational drug called etesiguat may slow valve calcification. In the study, the researchers detected a nearly 70% reduction in aortic valve calcification with etesiguat compared with a placebo at 6 months. People who took the drug also had better cardiac function. Dr. Darrow emphasizes this was a small study, but thinks the data are promising. There is an unmet need for drugs that slow aortic valve calcification, he says. Surgery an option. Until recently, surgery to replace a failing aortic valve typically was recommended only if aortic stenosis began to cause severe symptoms. However, some studies have suggested that this may not be the best approach, given that even asymptomatic aortic stenosis damages the heart, and advances in surgical techniques have made valve replacement a relatively low-risk procedure. Even so, if you are asymptomatic, Dr. Darrow says it is important to factor in your health status if you are thinking about surgery. Many studies enroll people with few coexisting conditions and a low risk for complications, he says. While surgery may be feasible for these individuals, it may not be the best choice for frail elderly people with asymptomatic stenosis. Valve replacement surgery involves transplanting a mechanical or a biological replacement valve in place of the failing valve. Once in position, the replacement valve's cusps mimic those of a natural valve, opening and closing with the rise and fall in blood pressure that occurs as the heart contracts. Each type of valve has pros and cons. For example, mechanical valves are more durable and last longer, so they may better suit people who are younger when they undergo surgery. However, they raise the risk of blood clots, so people who receive them need to take anticoagulant medication for the rest of their lives. Biological valves are made from animal tissue or other non-metallic materials, or may be taken from a donated heart. A biological replacement valve is less likely to cause a blood clot, Dr. Darrow notes. However, it won't last as long as a mechanical valve. So for that reason, older people are more likely to receive a biological valve. Most aortic valve replacement surgeries use a minimally invasive approach called transcatheter aortic valve replacement, or TAVR, T-A-V-R, which can be performed under sedation. During TAVR, a balloon catheter with a collapsible replacement valve at the tip is inserted into the femoral artery through a small incision and guided into the heart, Dr. Darrow explains. The catheter positions the replacement valve within the existing valve, and the balloon is expanded to open the replacement valve. The balloon is then deflated and the catheter is withdrawn. Recovery after TAVR typically is faster compared with surgical replacement or an open procedure, so it may offer a solution to frail older adults. However, Dr. Darrow notes that some research has associated TAVR with a risk of postoperative stroke. There also isn't much data on the longevity of valves replaced using TAVR, he adds. Open surgery requires a 6 to 8 inch incision down the center of your sternum or breastbone to access your heart. Your heart is stopped temporarily, and a heart-lung bypass machine is used to oxygenate your blood and pump it to your organs. After the old heart valve is removed, a new valve is stitched in place and checked for leaks. If all is well, you'll be taken off the bypass machine, your sternum will be repaired, and your incision closed. Valves replaced using the open procedure may last for up to 2 decades, Dr. Darrow says. But the surgery is considered high risk for people whose left ventricle is failing and for those who have had previous heart attacks. The recovery time is typically longer than with a TAVR, several weeks compared with a few days. If you are considering aortic valve replacement, have an in-depth discussion with your doctor about what surgical method is safest for you. And keep in mind that beyond the surgical method used, your recovery and well-being depend on following healthy lifestyle approaches that protect your heart health, Dr. Darrow concludes. From the same issue, tuberculosis, what you should know. If you had TB in your younger years, it may revive in older age. In 2024, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported over 10,000 cases of TB in the United States, an 8% increase over 2023 and the highest number of new cases since 2011. Older adults are at particular risk for TB due to age-related weakening of the immune system that increases their risk, says Dr. Sarah Tamer, an associate professor of medicine at Mount Sinai, who specializes in infectious disease. She adds that the bacterium that causes tuberculosis can be spread from person to person in the case of active tuberculosis. Active versus latent. People who develop active tuberculosis after exposure to the bacteria typically do so because their immune system is compromised by illness or medication. Only people with active TB can transmit the disease, Dr. Tamer says. When they cough, sneeze, or talk, they expel invisible infectious droplets that can survive suspended in the air for some time. This means if you live or work closely with someone who has active TB, you are at greater risk of developing the disease. Most people who encounter the bacteria have a strong enough immune system that they may not have any symptoms or even know that they have been infected. But it is possible for the bacteria to lie dormant in the body, and this is what we know as latent TB. If you have latent TB, you may live your whole life never knowing you were exposed. However, it may reactivate if your immune response wanes with age. Other factors that may cause latent TB to reactivate include comorbidities like diabetes, cancer, and rheumatoid arthritis, often because the medications used to treat these conditions suppress the immune system. Active TB typically causes general weakness, fatigue, unexplained weight loss, fever, and night sweats. People may experience a cough or cough up blood. Latent TB is asymptomatic until it revives. For this reason, adults who reside in nursing homes or other group settings are advised to get tested. TB can be detected using the MAN2 tuberculin skin test or with a blood test. However, neither test can clarify whether TB is latent or active. If your test results are positive, you'll be referred for additional imaging and testing to check your lungs for signs of active TB infection, Dr. Tamer says. Without treatment, active TB causes inflammation that produces tissue damage, scarring, and cavities in the lungs. The bacteria can move into the bloodstream and infect virtually any organ in the body. It is also possible for people to develop drug-resistant tuberculosis, which is harder to treat. Latent TB is treated with isoniazid or rifampin antibiotics, which are extended for 3 to 6 months. Successfully treating active TB takes longer and requires a combination of up to 4 drugs due to the ability of the TB bacteria to develop resistance. A few weeks after starting the drugs, a person with active TB typically will start to feel better and will no longer be contagious, says Dr. Tamer. However, it is vital to take the medication as directed to completely eliminate the bacteria. If the drugs are stopped too early, you may end up developing drug-resistant TB, which can be very challenging to treat. TB drugs can be toxic to the liver, and patients will be carefully monitored for side effects and should avoid consuming alcohol due to its potential impact on liver health. Symptoms that may indicate liver-related side effects include loss of appetite, nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, and jaundice. Such side effects should be immediately reported to your doctor.